So welcome back. We have finished our first chapter. Well, finished is really a relative term, but we tried to get through the first chapter of the purpose of the universe. What we're going to try to do now in this next step, as we learn through the Derech Hashem, is not to appreciate the universe as a whole, but to transcribe that idea into humanity. So where do we belong in that scheme of things? Now, we did touch on this at the beginning because a lot of the purpose of the universe centers around humanity's fulfilling their purpose, right? So we have that. But the question is specifically, how does that look in real terms? So let's start at the beginning. We move now into chapter what's called Perek Shlishi, the third chapter. Remember, the first chapter was describing God. We did not spend time on that Perek as much. We spent more time on the idea of the world. Now, what he does is he does a very wonderful thing, which is he gives us a summary of the previous chapter with one addition in the first paragraph, which is helpful. This will lay the groundwork for our discussion today, which I think is quite fascinating, because although we've seen the big ideas, we've not seen the specific ideas. Like, why does that translate to the world that we know, we feel, we touch? Why is it as it is? So let's start at the beginning. So he does a quick reminder. Kvar Zocharnu, he says, we've already mentioned, Heyos ha'adam oiso ha'briya ha'nivreis lidovek boy yisbor ha'shamayis. Since humanity is that creature which is meant to cleave to him. Why is cleaving to him the currency? Because why is cleaving to him the currency? It must be because that's the greatest form of good, right? So for it to be the greatest form of good, that's his giving of it, is for us to achieve this. And this creature is sort of in limbo or in balance between completion and deficiency. And the possibility, therefore, is to make the choice to be more shalem. This needs to be by this creation's own free will in order for this to work. If this creation had any reason to have to be forced, whether the compulsion is internally, externally, whether it is incentivization or force, whatever the reason is, then in that case, lo haya nikra ve'emes baal b'shlemusai. That achievement of that, based on that choice, would not really be complete. Lo haya kavanah el yana miskaimes. That would not be what Hashem wanted, because He wanted to give the greatest good to humanity. Okay? Therefore, huchrach shiyunach hadavar lebichirasai. It was left up to that creature's free will. Sheteh netiyasai shekula l'shnei atzadim. Therefore, it needs to be equally weighted. So this is now the new idea that he's introducing, which is for choice to work, choice needs to be balanced. Which means to say, you know, sometimes when we're dealing with our kids, we get into a situation where we say, you know, they don't want to get dressed. So you say, okay, do you want the blue shirt or the red shirt? Right? And you know, like, so, you know, you're giving them their space and they feel like they have autonomy, but really, you're just getting them dressed. Until then, a few weeks later, then they realize that they're just being tricked, right? So, or like when let's say as a parent, you sort of say, well, if you don't eat supper, you're going to bed right away, right? Look, they ate supper. What an obedient young child. So the truth is, in those cases, that's not really equally weighted, because the framework of choice or the options in the choices are not necessarily equally weighted. And that being the case, there would not therefore be a sincere decision-making process. You're trying to augment it because you have a meeting to go to, and supper time has to take place, and bath time. So you're helping the decision process along, but that's not really their choice. You're just taking away something or threatening something in order to get to what it is that you want. So that can't be. That's not a real choice. That has to be equally weighted. That being the case, so therefore he says, So the person has to be able to have the choice to choose and want each side. And also the possibility. So maybe that we want to, but you know, if you tell a person in a gulag in Siberia, make the choice to go to Hawaii. They can't make that choice, right? No matter how much they'd want to, it just isn't a possibility right now. Okay, nivra ha'adam yetzer tov v'yetzer ra. That's why we have in the control panel on the back of all of us, you know, there's two gauges. One is called a Yetzer Hara, one is called a Yetzer Tov. We have them inbuilt. And the person has the possibility of choosing what they want. So that's interesting, which means to say that the actual the algorithm of decision making actually is internal rather than external. Yes, there may be circumstances that we're put in which make the decisions for us difficult or make us to have to confront certain difficult situations, but ultimately speaking, it's actually internally. Internally, we have that so to speak razor blade that we stand upon to go either way, good or bad, and that's the Yetzer Tov or Yetzer Ra. Now, we know this and we talk about these terms, but I feel like we throw them around so easily without really understanding. Like, you know, because certainly in today's day and age, where, you know, we have everything is made into a cartoon or a video. So you kind of imagine, you know, like the white little figure on the right shoulder, and the dark red or dark black figure on the other shoulder, and whispering in your ear, which way, and you know, you're kind of that sort of very very childish kind of way of looking at things. That's not exactly how it works, right? It's not different voices. It's not different personalities. You know, one is not a charismatic. That's not what's happening over here. So how does that look? But the next paragraph. But just to appreciate right now, this is the framework necessary for us to be able to achieve greatest goodness, because then we can really make decisions. If we're really making decisions, we're making decisions which count, and there's nothing which is forcing us one way or the other on the critical decisions in our life. Now, there are many decisions we don't make enough, we don't have the opportunity of making, but the ones that really matter are the ones that are in front of us. Interesting enough. So just for a moment, just stop here and to think about this. That means to say that, let's say we're in a place in life where we couldn't make a decision, right? So that was taken away from us, right? So it's like the supper or bed options, you know? Or we just don't have that latitude. So that case, clearly that's a decision which is not something we're being rewarded or punished for. Make sense? Mm-hmm. That makes sense? But I mean, so like, if it's a situation where I just economically, psychologically, emotionally, physically, whatever it is, that I can't make that decision, right? I simply cannot. Then clearly that wasn't a decision which I'm going to be rewarded or punished on. And we spend a lot of time worrying about those decisions, you know? And it's interesting to sort of think about the sphere of control and the sphere of concern. We have a lot in our sphere of concern, but it's interesting that the most important ones are the ones that we can really truly make even weighted decisions. And those are the ones we try to avoid, but those are the real ones that count. It's easier to be in a situation of a victim of circumstance, but those are the ones that really make a difference in our life. So, okay, so good. So this is really a summary, but now he's introduced the two players. The two players are internal, Yetzer Tov, Yetzer Ra. What are they exactly? How do they make themselves heard in our lives? So here's how it goes. Here's his argument, and it's very simple, it's very basic, and it makes a lot of sense. He kind of hinted to this last week. So paragraph base. Ulam, nonetheless, heyos hadavar hazeh. By the way, you'll notice that so many of his paragraphs begin with the word ulam or omnam, but or however, which is fascinating. So what it essentially is doing for us is the following. I think if we were to have a conversation with the Ramchal, he would say, everything I'm saying here is self-evident. Right, he's saying, I'm not introducing to you ideas which you've never heard of, which don't make sense by themselves. I would like to tell you things which, if you spend enough time thinking about, you'd have to arrive at. So I've now described to you these all this. Now, I did introduce the idea, he says, of Hashem wanting to do good. Now, once you have that, you should automatically arrive at the conclusions I have, because the greatest good could only be if we're attaching ourselves to Him. You can only really achieve that if we're actually earning it. How could we really earn that if we're making free choices? We can only make free choices if... So every step of the way, it's almost however, because there's still pieces missing. It's almost as if, so the next logical step we may need to take is this. Here's the next logical step. So just to sort of follow on this way, it's almost as if everything he's saying is self-evident, and it makes so much sense. So now that he said these Yetzer HaTov and Yetzer Ra, so however, what does it mean? What does it look like? Heyos hadavar hazeh ne'elam nishlam karoi. For this to really work, gazra ha'chachma liyana shiyeh adam murkav rishnei afachim. A person, therefore, is also a composite of two opposite ingredients. Dahainu, minashaman, sikhli, sasaka, v'guf, artzi, v'akur. A person is comprised of a soul, which is cerebral and pure, and a body, which is material and gross, sort of gross in terms of like not pristine, not fine. Shekol echad mehem, yiteh b'teva letzidai. So each one is obviously pulling in its direction to its place where it finds its natural comfort. Sechliot. So the body pulls towards materialism because that's where it is made from, and the soul is pulling towards ideas, which is where it is pulled from. V'timotzei beinehem milchamah. So therefore, they're going to have this continual war. In the way that if the neshama makes the prevailing decisions, that it will therefore elevate that which is attached to it, because the body and the soul are inextricably connected during this world. So if it makes the right decision, the body is pulled with it. And the person therefore will be a complete human being. So if that's that person allows materialism to be the driving force of decision making, in that way, where the body, so to speak, returns to its quarry, its natural resting point, and it pulls the neshama with it. That person will be further away from completion. And therefore is further from Hashem. Every person has that opportunity to make those decisions. So now he's giving it in a little more clear terms. So Yetzer Hara and Yetzer Tov are a function of the different composite parts of our being. So if you want to sort of look at it, if you want to expand the spectrum for a moment now, so what we could say is like this. When you have an animal is really completely chomri. An animal does have instincts, which are more, the more we'll call it a cerebral part of an animal, but those are still really the lowest part of human soul. But the animal does have instinct, but that's really the highest you go when it comes to animals. They're really essentially a material being, and the material being has a few basic functions on earth, and they are eating, sleeping, reproduction, and survival. Basically, that's what animals spend all their time doing, and that's the material being. Then we have angels, this angelic host, which are not in any way bound by physicality, so much so that there's opinions, as an example, in this week's parasha, like the Rambam, so it suggests in Moreh Nevuchim that in Parshas Vayera, when it talks about Avram Avinu seeing the Melachim, he didn't see the Melachim because a human being who's bound by physicality cannot see a spiritual being. It must have been in a vision. So this whole Vayera story was in a dream. That's what the Rambam says, because it's so far, so distant is the cerebral reality of an angel to a human being. We don't have the capacity. Our five senses are too limiting for us to see beyond. So that not everybody agrees with that. Most people disagree with that, but just get a sense of how far it is. So let's look at those opposite ends of the spectrum. So you have a spiritual being, you have a physical being, and now you have the human being, which is kind of this in-between, where God fused the two together. If you actually go back to it, if you remember just 3 weeks ago when we looked at Bereishis, when God described the creation of the human being, the word he used was, Na'aseh Adam, let us make man. Right? It's a very confusing statement. You know, it sort of kind of feeds into certain religions that believe there's a few folks up there, you know, and not just one monotheistic God. So why would Hashem word it in such a ambiguous and misleading way? So there's a number of explanations given. Rashi famously says he's consulting, but the Ramban says a different thing. He says like this: if you look at the creation on day six, the first thing Hashem says was Toitzei Aretz. Let the land produce nefesh chaya, these living beings, which is animals, right? So animals are a product of the earth, which means to say the basic components of inorganic matter are going to come together to form a life-bearing matter. It's made of the same carbon, it uses the same systems of energy. It all comes from earthliness. Then Hashem says, well, I'm going to make a deal with you, earth. I'm going to make a deal with you, periodic table. You're going to produce for me a material base, a platform, and I, together with you, earth, na'aseh, we, will make a human being. I'll invest the spiritual part, you invest the physical part, and together we'll create this composite being called the human being. Very complex, right? It doesn't work so well. It's so hard. It's always at odds with itself. So that's really the human being. That's what he's describing now. So this is such a basic binary principle. You know, it's so obvious then to us. It's just funny. We struggle with this. We may know this, but this happens all the time to us. We always have decisions between values and convenience. Always, all the time, right? I'm asked to do something which is a value-based and idea-based thing, but conveniently speaking, it's out of my way, right? Conveniently speaking, it's not to my cup. It's going to make me tired. It's going to make me miss my coffee. It's going to make me whatever it is. These decisions are happening all the time. So what he's saying is that when you're in the middle, when you feel that pull on each side, we need to ask ourselves what's pulling us one way, what's pulling us the other way, and if it's value versus pleasure, value versus convenience, value versus comfort, then that's clearly what we're talking about over here, because one side is pulling one way, one side is pulling the other way. Just interesting enough, the way that the Midrash describes this, you notice he doesn't quote Midrashim, he doesn't beat around the bush. He says very basic principles in very clear language. This is encyclopedic. He's doing it in a very clear way. But what he's referring to is that there's a number of Midrashim which describe this. So one Midrash describes the following interesting union, where you have a princess who's the heiress to a large kingdom, but she kind of has her own way of thinking about things, and her dad and her mom are not so happy about her, so to speak, perspectives on life. She grows up in a more progressive generation, and she falls in love. She's not into the kind of set up marriages business, and so she falls in love with this very handsome fellow who happens to be a woodchopper. And the father and the mother try to convince her. The more they try to convince her, the less she's interested in listening to them, and she ends up going out and getting married with this fellow, until she realizes that where she's going to live is at a hut in the middle of the woods. Right, so after the marriage, they go back to their and they come back from their honeymoon, and they're going to go to his wonderful ramshackle hut, and he takes her in, and he is so excited, and he wants to give her everything he possibly can. So he goes and he picks potatoes out of the backyard, and he slices them in two, and he puts them in the oven to bake her potatoes, which is his favorite dinner. And as she looks at it with the wooden spoons which are mismatched and served on these cracked plates, She there's a certain revulsion in her, and he's so sad because he's trying so hard to give her what it is that she wants, and ultimately it's not really what she wants, and no matter what he does, it doesn't really work, and she's disappointed, he's frustrated, and it's a very difficult situation. Says the Midrash, what that means is that's kind of the journey of the soul to this world. The soul comes from a much different, a much more celestial place. It's drawn out of a quarry of complete spirituality, and it's placed into this very, what he calls a guf chomri v'achur, this backwards, very rudimentary body. And the body tries to give the soul what it wants, but it just keeps giving it more donuts and coffee. And the soul is used to ideas and cerebral, ethereal experiences. And it keeps looking at these baked potatoes and just can't get to like them. And that's kind of the experience we have. We have this yearning. And sometimes what we do is, because we have this spiritual yearning, we try to fill it with things, right? And the more we fill it, the plumper we get. But the less happy the soul necessarily is, because it's not the right currency for what it was necessarily looking for. So that's kind of a little bit where he's going in this direction. And there's this battle of choice, and the battle of choice is stemming from two parts of our personality. Well, one which is more spiritual, one which is more material. Makes a lot of sense, and we've all heard these ideas. It's just the way he's framing it over here is that is how the experiment is meant to be. It's just so interesting because we can't escape ourselves, right? We can't escape the fact that we have bodily needs. We can't escape the fact that we have spiritual needs, and they both are warring for our attention all the time, from the moment we wake up till when we go to sleep. Now, okay, so this is the framework. Now we need to get into let's nitty gritty. So how does that work? So how does that look? So in order for this to work, he says, however, v'omnam, clearly we're not at the end of the journey here. So in paragraph Gimel, gozar tuvo yizvorah sheyeh gvul ishtadlus hazeh hamitzarech la'adam lahasig hashleimus. For any good test, you need to have an endpoint, right? So let's say you have a standardized test and there are 7 billion questions. Nobody's going to pass that test because there's no way to finish that test. So clearly there has to be 20 questions, 30 questions, 40. There needs to be a limit as to how long it is that we're in this obstacle course to make these decisions. How many decisions are we being given on this test? And therefore, when we finish that test, then we achieved it because we passed all these increasingly difficult decisions in our life. And then we can achieve completion because that was the whole point of this. So God therefore obviously needed to create two separate time zones. So obvious, right? You need to have a time where we're working, we're being tested, decisions are being made, and then there's a time where we're cashing in, lahavdil, right, where we're receiving. Now, remember, he pointed out that the two are interconnected, and that the better the decision I make, the better my so to speak, zman kibul, the kibul sachar, receiving the reward, and who I am, meaning they're interconnected. It's not like I'm, you know, getting the tokens and I'm getting the prize. I'm actually a better person by the decisions I'm making, but nonetheless, there's two different times for doing and for receiving. We've seen this kind of idea. I'm sure we've heard this kind of idea. This idea is all through Talmudic thought, is clearly replete there. You know, example being, there is the Gemara in Avodah Zarah talks about how at the end of time, the nations of the world are going to come in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to stand up there metaphorically with a Sefer Torah and says, anybody who is involved in these ideas, come and receive your reward. And there's a clamoring, everybody comes to God and says, you know, God, we do all these wonderful things for you and for the nation of Israel. And Hashem says, not really. And they ask for a second chance, the nations of the world, and Hashem says, I'll give you a mitzvah kala, an easy mitzvah, and he gives the mitzvah sukkah famously. And the Gemara interjects and says, wait a second, hayom la'asai samu l'machol ha'kabel scharam, that the rules of the game are, is that the mitzvahs are to be done today, and tomorrow to receive reward. So it's not fair, after the game's finished, you know, there's that kid who says, can I take the test again? It's like, no, I gave you the rule book. It was pretty clear, right? If you wanted to read it, the Bible was on any shelf in any motel. You could work it out, right? So if you think about this, you know, it makes sense. There has to be a limit, and this is the basic idea. Therefore, he goes on, v'ulam, however, midah satov amaruba she'avoda yesh lo zman uchukok. Hashem is generous to us, that he gives us the earlier time, which is the working time, that's the test-taking period, is a limited period. K'mo she'gozra chachmasa yisborach shemoy, because that's what Hashem wanted it to be. He wanted it to be easier for us. But receiving reward, that's without end. That's very hard for us to grasp, right? We like ends, we like boundaries, we like measuring things and graphing them. But it doesn't have an end, right? And why is that necessary, by the way? Empirically, why is that necessary? Because if you're attaching yourself to God, and God is infinite, then there can't be an end to that, right? So that obviously that has to be that's the necessary definition of that period, which is hard for us to perceive. But clearly, this period is limited. Now, just to clarify, that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, I think perhaps the way that a lot of people think of this is well, human lifespan is limited, right? So we live. That's true, but it's actually more than that. It also means to say the entire confine of Olam Hazeh is limited. Right, there's a specific end point to Olam Hazeh as well. So this world's going to end at a certain point when it turns over to Olam Haba. Which comes down to an interesting debate, which is just worthwhile noticing. And that is that what happens to a person after death? Although there are reports of folks who do come back, but generally speaking, we don't have so many people telling us about what's going on there. So we look into Torah sources, and Torah sources tell us that it was actually a little bit of a debate. There are those like the Rambam who understand that a person automatically enters into Olam Haba, into the world to come, which essentially is a parallel world to the world that we're in. So a person passes away at the time, hopefully that it's appropriate to them, and then their soul then detaches, enters into Olam Haba. It's the parallel track, essentially. Most people disagree with the Rambam. The Ramban in the Shara Gemul as being one of the predominant colleagues who argue on the Rambam. And clearly, the Derech Hashem is going in the direction of the Ramban, which is the Kabbalistic track, which is that we'll see this more in detail. But after a person dies, they do not go to Olam Haba. There's a waiting room. When a person dies, it's still Olam Hazeh. Olam Hazeh is, if you think of what you just said now, there's a fixed time for this world. When a person dies, they have not left this fixed time. They're in a spiritual part of this world, but it's still Olam Hazeh. When does Olam Haba start? When does that period of receiving reward start? That's at a fixed point in the future. That's going to be when the entire world is going to either enter or not enter it. Right? It's very in or out. There's no partially in or out. When it comes to that, that's in the future. That means to say the resurrection of the dead will be when bodies and souls are reunited to have another opportunity or chance in this world. And then at the end of that will be Olam Haba. Just to clarify what he's saying here, this is a matter of debate, which he is taking a side on as it goes. Yes, Ilana.
So, is he saying that when you die now, you stay here in this world?
He hasn't said that, but he hasn't given us the details. But yes, it's not in this world in terms of this world, you know, North America, you know, But it means to say that in the spiritual part of this world, which is a limited world, it's still a world which has a gvul to it.
So okay? We say someone that died is now on to the Kisei HaKavod.
Really, it's Gan Eden is a better term to talk okay, about it. Yeah, it's a me'ain. It's what's called me'ain Olam Haba. It's not really Olam Haba itself. So it's similar to. He'll get to some of these details soon as well. Okay, yeah. Well, it's good to know that there's these specifics. You know, it has to all fit into place, right? It has to fit into place. Yes, yes, Rosemary.
So the question is, what's your name?
Ilana.
So when a person, we say, he passed away. So he's in the waiting room now? Because when my late sister passed away, I said to the rabbi, I can't believe it. I have so many questions. And he said, don't worry. When you get to see her one day, whenever it'll be, it'll all be in front of you. You'll have no questions because it'll be there. And I've heard that a few times. It'll all be there. All the questions.
It all makes sense, right? So,
all the questions we have about why that person, why how. Sorry, it's gonna be. Why are you sorry?
Oh no. So we will get there. I don't want
That's his opinion. This is one man's opinion.
No.
Many.
No. This is predominant Jewish thought. This is mainstream Jewish thought. Yeah, I wanted to point out that there is a minority opinion of the Rambam who views it somewhat differently, the Maimonides. But I don't want to get into the afterlife thing because he's not talking about that right now. That's going to be a later topic if we have a chance to get there. But I do want to point out that this argument itself has ramifications in terms of post death. It's still Olam Hazeh. It's still part of that fixed time. That's what he's saying. Yes.
Is this where this concept is where you get the concept of Gilgul Neshama?
Complicated. Yes, but because it's part of that. Yes. By necessity, if a neshama hasn't yet finished its job, it's going to possibly or part of it. We'll have to come back to finish that particular role because it's still in.
Okay,
exactly.
If you're in a hallway, okay. You know,
correct.
Come back and finish your job.
Correct. So it's a, okay. Now what that hallway looks like is very complex, but it happens to be it's still a part of the confines of Olam Hazeh. Okay, so folks, all he's done right now is he's just said is that for this whole experiment to work, and when I say experiment, I don't mean it lightly, because it's not as if this is this is us, this is our reality. But for this whole idea, this whole concept to work, it needs to have two separate times. Make sense? And we call that Olam Haba and Olam Hazeh. Right? So now, the next step is we've talked about separation of time. The next point we need to talk about is separation of place. So however, right, so the next logical step we need to make is, in paragraph Dalet, V'ulam, Kafi ha'yizchalev zmanoi, according to the differences of times, kach ro'el ishiyizchalev matzavoy osha mikrav. Not only the time is different from each other, they're distinct, but what happens in each of them has to be different. All the time of working, that's the Olam Hazeh, needs to be in a one particular manner or characteristic. It needs to have all the necessary inventory for it to work. For it needs to have all the wherewithal in it. For that to work, Perush, what does that mean? Ki hine muchrach shetimotzei loy hamilchama shezacharnu b'dasecho l'achomer. It needs to have the war between the ideas and the material. V'loy yedavol adavor shi'akev esachomer midishloit v'lasois es shaloi. And there cannot be anything in that space which will stop the decision being made freely. Kifi ashir aroy loy, as it's needed. So there should be nothing in what we call Olam Hazeh, this world, which is going to make the weight of that internal decision process of that creature called human being more tilted towards chomrios, materialism, or more tilted towards ruchanios, which is spirituality. There should be nothing in this place and container, so to speak, which is going to augment one side over the other, because that is internal. We are a human being internally. There should be nothing on the outside of this space which is going to pull us one way more than the other. Ki av al pi shemitzad echad hayon nirei ze yoser tov, hinei lefi hakavon ameitis va'inyan anirtze bo adam shu kinyas ha-shlemus bishtad lusoi, einenu tov. You may say, Wouldn't it be nice if God made it easier for human beings to make spiritual decisions? Just give them extra clues, right? Make it a little easier. Candy at the end of the road. Way stations. Make it easier. Something. So the truth is, it may seem good, but it's not really good. Why? Because what's the whole point of good? Like, that's the whole point of good is God giving the greatest good. The greatest good is if we choose it. So if we're choosing it, it needs to be an equal decision, or otherwise it's the child otherwise being sent to bed. So if they're not being, if that's the reason why they make the decision, that isn't really their own choice. If it isn't really their own choice, therefore they don't really own that decision. So it may seem like it's good to help prompt the human beings along the way. That's not good, really, because that's not really therefore real ownership. So Hashem, if you would just make it easier, Hashem says, I'm trying to just make decisions. Just do what you're supposed to do right now. Right? So I shouldn't just go reach down into our life and tell me and let the voice come from heaven. And no, Hashem says, I'm not making it easy because that's not good. That's not good for you, my child. Right? That's what it seems to be. Ubizman akibul sachar. In the time a person receives reward, and therefore in the second time zone, which is Olam Haba, it is the opposite. Kihine. All control of the material in that time. If there was too much materialism in Olam Haba, then it would actually be a hindrance of cleaving to Hashem. And the whole point of that is being close to Hashem. Well, again, and that's why. At that point in time, it should be only the neshama which is in control that time. Materialism should be pooled with the spiritualism as well, which makes a lot of sense. If you might hear the parable, the mashal of a trainer, the Yetzer Hara being like a trainer, right? So every time you fall to the ground again, they get up. You have to do your work harder, and they keep pushing you down and making and pushing you beyond your limits. And so when you finish the training course, they're not going to torture you anymore, right? Because you did what you needed, right? You reached that benchmark. Same kind of thing. In this world, the trainer's there, so to speak. The Yetzer Hara is there. The Chomrius is a very significant force in our life. It comes to the Olam Haba, that recesses because it now is pooled next to the spirituality. You'll notice something interesting over here as well, is he does not say that the world to come is completely devoid of physicality. Did you notice that? He says that the physicality will be subsidiary and pulled towards the spirituality. Also, another matter of debate is Olam Haba. Again, comes back to the same debate of the Rambam and Ramban. Is Olam Haba something which is fully spiritual, or is it physical as well? Now you'll say, of course it's spiritual. The Rambam says, there's when you read the Gemara, Tzadikim Yoshim V'Atrosem B'Roshem V'Ne'enim V'Ziv Ashkenadei. The righteous are sitting there with the crowns on their heads and they're enjoying the splendor of the Shekhinah. It's a cerebral reality. There's no body because bodies don't fit into the world of spirituality. Like the Rambam says, a human being can't see an angel. It had to be a vision. The Rambam also says when we go to the world to come, there ain't nothing else. It's just spirituality. You can't take pictures of it. It's not in the dimensions and the senses that we measure things with. That's what the Rambam says. However, it should be noted, the Ramban, as is adopted by mainstream Jewish thought, which is what the Derech Hashem is saying, he's saying, no, there will be a body because a human being still is a human being. It's just that the body will be refined sufficiently to be able to get there, which is why the body goes through a process of refinement in the grave. Then the soul goes through a process of refinement after we call it the station in what we have is our physical world around us. They are reunited to enter into Olam Haba at that point in time. So you just notice that detail, which is significant over here. The Ramban does point out that in that Gemara, which says, Tzadikim Yoshim, it still talks about sitting and their heads and crowns, which are all physical descriptions. So his point is that when he's like, if it wanted to be so it just happens to be there are details in there which are also physically what that looks like, complicated, what it means to refine a human body to the point of being deserving of being in a spiritual format is something quite profound. And finally he says, well, Amnam, nonetheless, that's why we have two worlds. Olam hazeh v'olam haba. Olam hazeh, this world, hamakom havachukim hativiyim shelo, has its own rules. Hey, mashiro le'adam kol zman shehishtadlus, in order to create this obstacle course. V'olam haba, hamakom havachukim shelo, and the world to come has its own rules. Hey, mashiro lo bizman kibul asachar, which is necessary for receiving the reward. So we just look backwards on the last two paragraphs. We looked at paragraph Dalet and paragraph Gimel. Paragraph Gimel says it's empirically necessary for there to be two separate times. And now in paragraph Dalet, he explains, and therefore there needs to be different worlds to contain those times. One's finite, one's infinite. One has to have a heavier, we'll call absence of Hashem, or a heavier focus on the material for the decision making to be equal, and the world to come where the spirit, the material is less of an ingredient in order for this for the person to be able to receive infinite reward from the decisions they made in this world. Okay, so it makes sense. This is where it comes from. So if you were to say, like, how do we know this Olam HaBa Zeh and Olam HaBa? Essentially, the Derech Hashem, the Ramcha would say, well, if you just take these logical steps, you will arrive at the basic conclusion that it has to exist. Right, for this whole idea to work. It's such a beautiful way of thinking. Okay, folks, we're good? This is where we're up to right now. So this is all necessary next steps. So now, you may say to yourself, wait a second. So he has just made an argument which doesn't seem to sit right. It's important to ask the questions when it doesn't sit right. Because one of the arguments he just made is that in this world, everything is equally weighted, right? Everything is equally weighted. So we have the ability to be able to listen to our material needs or our spiritual needs and make those decisions. And the world is not meant to be a hindrance in either direction, because it would be too much of a hindrance of materialism. It would be too hard for us. And if it would be too weighted towards the spiritual, it would be unfair for the experiment, for this whole process to work. Right? So we say to ourselves, I don't know. It's a pretty materialistic world around us. Right? Is it just the 21st century? Or is it really hard to make decisions? Right? So meaning to say, like, we walk outside and basically our whole lives we're pulled by all kinds of alluring things. And not necessarily bad things, just physical things, you know? So, like, so much of our life we spend all these decisions, we're being pulled, like, all these billboards and all these ideas and all this convenience and this pleasure and this comfort, which is the basic currency of society around us, right? Convenience and entertainment are the two most important assets in Western society. Everything else works up to them. The entertainment industry is way more important to people than politics. Unless the politics are getting in the way of their comfort. And like, meaning to say, think about it. This is not the realm of the founding fathers of America anymore. This is about barbecues on Labor Day. I'm saying, like, nobody's thinking about any of these things. We're dealing with a world of comfort and convenience, entertainment. That's what it is. I once remember when I was walking past Madison's the garden, and like, there was like, you know, a 20 story, and it was the time when Shrek 3 came out, you know? And it was like this huge billboard, like floor upon floor of Shrek 3. I was thinking to myself, this is what the society celebrates. You know, it's like what sells the most amount of tickets at the local theater, right? That's what it is. You know, you go to other societies which are more ideal-based, and by the way, there's bad countries out there with bad ideals. But like at the time when ISIS was around, I'm saying the banners were not about entertainment, right? They were about destroy America and destroy the West. They were believing it was an idea. It's not a entertainment. You understand? So like, we live in a world that's just completely, completely entertainment and convenience. How often do you ever see a billboard that, you know, that talks about an idea? Now, sometimes you go deep in Slovenia, you can find the ones about the church billboards. That's wonderful. But most of them are selling something or some sort of lifestyle or convenience or product or something. Think about so like, is what he's saying really an accurate reflection of the world that we're in? That's the next step that he has to take. Rosemary.
Sitting and learning all day with his wife and baby, and the word is outside. He said, "I want to go outside." The key word is outside. He was sitting and learning 6 days a week, Shabbat with the family, and then he went back to the yeshiva and he wasn't outside to be tempted. Isn't it easier? Well, we're not going to discuss that now. That's another chapter. To sit and learn all day as the Berlin dog all around the world, a voice, and then to sit.
Look, you can certainly cloister yourself. There's no question. I'm just saying, a default person who lives in society around themselves, it doesn't seem to be the very basic world that he's describing. It's very hard to make decisions which are about ideas today. That's what I'm saying. It doesn't seem like that's the way society is oriented. That's why you comment. So you're right. You can change that. I agree. But I'm just saying, default person going through a default society, we are buffeted and pulled in ways which seem to be very weighted towards one side of this equation, more than another. So that being the case, how's that reality? So the answer is, he's about to answer. We're only at the beginning of the story here. So now the next step is the following: is that something changed? It did change. It didn't change in 2021. It changed many, many years ago. Here's how it goes. In paragraph A, you need to know the following truth. What we look around us in the world around us is not what humanity used to be. There was a tremendous watershed moment. This was mentioned last week. It was a sin, and that sin changed the framework of reality. From what it was before. The implication and the outcome, the collateral outcome of that change is incredible. We're going to talk about it later on. Anytime you talk about the human experiment, the human idea, it needs to be in two separate conversations. You need to talk about Adam and Eve pre-sin, and you need to talk about post-sin. As he's about to explain. So you wonder, why does the world look different? He's saying, I was talking about pre-sin. This whole idea I told about here was we're called Plan A. Let's analyze the difference between Plan A and Plan B. So Plan A, Vav, in paragraph Vav. Hine, Adam HaRishon Be'ez Yetzira Sohya Mamash Be'oysa Matzav She'zacharnu Ad Hena. The what I've described to you up to now, the equally weighted decision-making, that was all Adam 1. Now, not to confuse with Genesis 1 versus Genesis 2, the two prokim, Aleph and Beis, that's a whole other topic. But Adam, pre-sin. Dahaino, Jehu haya murkav mishnei achalakim afchayim shamarnu. He was comprised of two different components, Shem and Hashama v'aguf, that's soul and body. Uvemetzius hayu shnei ha'inyanim hatov ha'ra, and they had both good and bad in him, v'omeid b'shikul b'neim, and he was equally suspended between the two of them, Yidobek Bamash Yirtsemahim, to make that choice. Vineha Yara Uloshi Yivchor Batov the Yagbir Nishmasal Gufod, by making the decision of good versus bad, which was not to eat, to listen to God, he would have elevated his body, Vesikhloy Al Khamra, and his intellect over his material, Vaz Hoya Mishtalem Yad, and he would be immediately completed. Vinach Bishlemus Lanesach, and that would have been it. So it's so interesting. We think of this world as a complex, long, arduous journey. The truth was that round one was a very simple binary experiment. It was the way it was sent up. And let's go back to the idea. The idea is Hashem wants to give the greatest good to someone else. So Hashem creates a space and then there's someone else in that. That someone else needs to earn it, so they need to make a choice. So why does there have to be so many choices? There's just one choice. There weren't 613 choices. There was one choice. And that was God says, eat these, don't eat that. Right, was it? That was the choice. Right? And ultimately speaking, if they made the right decision, if human beings had made the right decision, boom, that whole purpose of the universe would have been fulfilled. It would have been it, done, finished. Eternal reward, given a goodness for eternity. It would have been so simple. Right? If you think about it, it wouldn't have been the world that we know of at all. It would have all worked out. But Tzarek Shetada, you should know, when we try to sense our soul, whenever he talks about, I sense my soul, you should always either be worried or very attentive to that person, because not everybody is very in touch with their soul, right? So we sense our soul, he says, when we reflect on our intellect and our more ethereal emotions. Zulas achios haskala. V'inei be'emes yesh b'chukov. The soul has the capacity to elevate and purify our body, making those decisions by following its call. Until the body can accompany the soul in its experience. You see, very spiritual people. And clearly their body is you know, an attachment to their soul. Right? They've got a very big soul, and it's attachment, it's kind of following in line with that soul. That's what would have happened to a human being. The body would have been snapped back to where the soul was. And it would have been eternally attached to a spiritual being. He would have tilted the scale towards this being a spiritual being, not just being a material being. However, but since the human being decided, He does not get into right now why the human being would sin. I would like to leave that as a question. Why the human being would choose option B? Because it was clearly not just a mistake on a whim. There was much more to it. But nonetheless, the human being did sin. There was quite a lot of changes that happened. At the beginning of the creation, there was deficiency, like we talked about. This we're called shadow, lacking God's presence places in the world, right? In order to facilitate that equally weighted choice of a human being. And he could therefore achieve completion through his choices. Then when a person sinned, material became more of a factor internally and externally. The human being, so to speak, the weight on the spectrum was pulled more towards the material. And therefore became harder to fix what was before. Perush, what does that mean? At the beginning, you could easily escape. It was a 50-50 choice to choose completion. Because that was how the experiment was conducted. This whole idea was conducted in absolute good and justness. The only reason that bad needed to exist was as the necessary, the requisite hurdle to overcome. At the moment I avoid or I overcome this hurdle, I no longer need that hurdle, and therefore the hurdle goes away. When we sinned, that completion now is hidden more. Now there's more deficiency around us. And we did it to ourselves, after all. It becomes harder to make those decisions to get towards completion. We have a few more steps to make just to get halfway and then to make the decision. And this is as he explains. So therefore, the work necessary for us to arrive at real completion is doubled to what it was in Plan A. First, we need to return to our pre-chet existence, where we had that equally weighted experiment. And then, and then make that decision right the next time around. There have been a few times in history where that was attempted, by the way. Right? So when you hear the Midrashim, which talk about Noach leaving the Tabor and he's experimenting with the van and so on, and the Midrashim said that he was trying to fix the chet of Adam Arishon, a lot of comparisons, right? You know, three sons, right? Dealing with this fruit, according to one opinion, the chet of Eitz Hadas was in fact the grape as well. There's a lot of interesting things. What he was trying to get back to that primordial stage. When you hear about Har Sinai, the notion that the Midrash talks about of Pasku Zuha Masam, that something of the Nachash in us left, we could return to that state. Unfortunately, the chet Egel did not help that process. We sort of returned. So a few moments in history where humanity, or at least some of humanity, tried to get to this point. But his main point over here is that we are now in a much more complex reality, in a reality which is automatically, by default, more weighted towards material, which is the world we notice and see around us. And our first goal is to get back to pre-chet, then to make the decision correctly. That's going to be a lot of work. That's a lot of work to do as well. This is only difference number one. I don't want to rush this next point. So I think now is actually a good place to stop before we try to complete this chapter, but this is also going to therefore change the way in which our actions are reflected in the world around us. If Adam and Chava had made the right decision at the time, their results would have been immediate, right? So immediately they would have seen the fruit of their action of making this decision of spiritual versus material. In the world that we live, we don't live like that, right? We make good and bad decisions and nothing seems to change, right? Nothing seems to change around us, which makes it easier for us to rationalize bad decisions and easier for us to dismiss good decisions. because we just don't see immediacy when it comes to those reactions. And so we're going to discuss a little bit of that, Mr. Shem, in the coming weeks, the complex reality of Olam Hazeh Part 2, Plan B, which is really where we are. So it's what he's done is he's moved really from last week where the realm was this ideas, like why we need the system, as to why the system, how the system started, how the system morphed into something else, and where we live in that. Now we're going to develop those details a little more to get a sense of where we belong in that system. Complicated, but really, really fascinating, and so I appreciate it. Any questions, thoughts, observations? Okay, yes, Jenny. Oh, good question. Well, we also make bad decisions as well. Right? I mean to say, like, so although it's true that a lot of those decisions are because of the body, but we also make bad spiritual decisions too, right? So there's certain things that we do need to tick on because it has an impact on our soul. The soul is made of multiple levels, so whether it be 3, 5, 10 levels, it just depends how you grade the different parts of it. But the lower levels are influenced by the decisions we made as well. In the same way that the body can be purified, the soul can be muddied as well. Not the highest level, but the lower levels can be somewhat contaminated to a certain degree, and that contamination needs to be removed as well. So there's a certain period of cleansing necessary. Better to do cleansing in this world than to have to do cleansing in the post-life. Just the general rule about things as well.